So we never bootstrapped dogmatically. We always bootstrap pragmatically, and we bootstrapped for more than 5 years. So in a way, we skipped seed big time in those 5 years. We evaluated roughly every 3 months whether we wanted to raise funds now from the get-go. So we thought about it from the beginning and then had regular check-ins on if now would be the right time to raise funds for the company. And throughout those first 5 years, we always said, right now, our time is best spent on building product, on acquiring additional customers, on making the product stickier and things like that.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Venture Europe with me, Colleen Fabry. Our guest today is Kayetan von Armsberg, co-CEO of Leapsum. Leapsum is an all-in-one platform for people enablement. They combine the tools for goals and OKRs management, performance reviews and 360s, compensation and surveys, and many, many others. More than 1,500 companies, including Spotify, Northvolt, and Unity, use Leapsum platform to build high-performing teams. After bootstrapping for 5 years, in 2022, they've raised a $60 million round. Say what? $60 million round from Inside Partners, Creandum, and Visionaries Club. During this episode, we discuss about the importance of staying frugal, their bootstrapping journey from 0 to 10 million ARR, and the decision process of skipping seed and later opening an office in New York. Many thanks to Sebastian Pollock for the intro. Very much appreciated. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Kayetan von Armsberg. Pretty sure I pronounced that wrongly. Co-CEO of Leapsum. This episode is brought to you by EDA, the most collaborative tool for VCs and private equity investors that allows you to see in real time the true dimension of your investments and the value and impact they create. EDA combines deal flow, portfolio, LPs, and business community management in one place. From investment decision processes to managing due diligence, supporting portfolio companies, data sharing, and transparency, EDA streamlines the investment journey and fund operation management in an easy-to-use platform. To find out more about how EDA can revolutionize your investments, head to EDA.co. That is EDDA.co for a demo. Don't forget to use the code VPEDA and say that you're a friend of the pod. Let's start with a founding story of Leapsum. Tell me about the day you met Jenny, and then maybe the moment that you decided to take the plunge and start Leapsum.
Jenny and I actually go way back to, I think, 2008 or 2009, when we were still studying. Jenny was studying in Switzerland. I was kind of on a gap year between my studies in Mannheim and in Paris. And we met for a seminar over a weekend, which, yeah, sparked a very interesting friendship. We then stayed in touch for the next 10 years or so. We both lived in Berlin, and that really helped to occasionally see each other on parties and over dinner and things like that. Then roughly 6 years ago, we're both at a phase in our careers where we wanted to try something new. We had both worked for a while. I had been at Rocket Internet, was part of a venture, fintech venture, that had been acquired by another company. So I'd gone through the entire growth phase from 3 people initially to roughly 80 people 1.5 years later, then acquired by a much larger company. And many things in that journey had gone very well, but there were some things on the cultural side that could have been even better, and kind of triggered by that learning experience, wanted to start something in the field of people and culture development. And Jenny had gone through a very similar experience in her previous job. So we shared that similar background and similar experience and similar pain points as well, and started talking and wanted to embark on that journey together of starting a platform that could actually help you build and scale successful company culture.
And was it a meeting? Was it a phone call? Do you remember what specifically it was? Like, hey, let's start something together. Was it one of the parties?
Yeah. It actually started as a phone call, like roughly 1 hour phone call, where we actually started brainstorming quite intensely different ideas that we found interesting in that space. Then actually stayed in touch with them for the next couple of months. And Jenny went to California to participate in an accelerator program, which was unrelated to our idea. I went on a long trip through with the Trans-Siberian Railway from St. Petersburg to Beijing. But we both kept thinking about ideas in that space, and then reunited a couple of months later back in Berlin to actually start Leapsum, which obviously wasn't called Leapsum at the time. And that's an interesting experience of how you actually find a name for a company. But yeah, started working on the project.
So what was the first step that you guys took? So 1 year from the first phone call, then you come together after 1 year and like, hey, I've been still thinking about this problem. What should we do next? Did you focus on looking at the market, understanding the market better, or you already had some ideas about the market? Did you look at talent that might be helpful?
So we had a pretty concrete hypothesis of what we wanted to solve. We wanted to modernize feedback and learning at the workplace. We thought at the time that the solution was a very closed loop between instant feedback and recommended learning materials based on the instant feedback that you would receive from your colleagues. And we started in a very typical way for a startup, I would say. We actually sat together in the kitchen of my former flat and had a flip chart and lots of post-its, and we're brainstorming different product ideas on how this could come to life. And we're kind of looking for teammates, but also wanted to just get started and wanted to start build something and wanted to start selling what we had built. And yeah, just did that. Started prototyping, started selling the at the time very, very ugly prototype to customers that were brave enough to even take a look at that. And then actually closed our first customer roughly 5 months after we came together for the first time in that kitchen with a flip chart.
So how big is the team at this moment in time? Is it just you and Jenny, or who coded the product? Did you outsource it just to build the prototype or the MVP and to kind of sell it just to test your assumption?
So at this moment in time, and actually for the next 2 years, it was just the two of us. It was a very small team of two. I was working on the product and we didn't outsource anything. And Jenny was doing her magic selling what we built.
And what was the decision process? What happened after 2 years that you guys were, okay, we're onto something. We need to scale, we need to hire. How many clients did you have then that you realized that you can't serve them?
So after 2 years, I actually don't know the customer count, but we kept working on that idea of instant feedback and learning as a platform for roughly a year or so. And we're selling a couple of pilots of that product, which unfortunately churned rather quickly again. So there was always initial interest and lots of feedback on that this is actually a very interesting idea and could work very well. But then the product wasn't sticky enough and customers would unfortunately leave us again. And that, of course, over time becomes a very humbling experience. If you see that you have a product that sparks interest, but it's not really sticky enough. So we realized we had to think a bit more broadly and think about what the actual pain points of our customers were, and found out that performance management as a category actually is something that's very outdated in many companies. In many cases, pen and paper-based process, and sometimes people use Google Docs or Excel sheets and things like that. It's usually not a great process and something that we could easily make a lot better. And once we started realizing that and started that we could actually build a bridge from our very modern product to kind of the old world of performance management and could make that much more appealing and much more forward-looking, much more learning-oriented, we saw real product market fit and saw that customers actually bought this product and also stayed our customers for much longer. I don't know the actual customer count after 2 years, but that's when we started seeing a first real traction.
How did you assess the concern of if it's performance management, is this going to be a tool that it's used maybe only once a quarter? Did you think about that or?
We did think about it, but we also still had the other features in the platform that we had built originally, instant feedback, although some other smaller features around meeting management and the likes. And that wasn't really a concern that it would be used too infrequently.
And interesting, right? Because you have a product that gives you the product market fit, but maybe it's not used as frequently, but then you have all this feature catalog that the frequency is much higher to build this platform that kind of helps company manage their employees.
And I mean, today the platform is even broader, right? You have performance management, you have OKR management, you have learning management, you have the engagement service, and you have meetings and instant feedback. And especially meetings and instant feedback are features that would be used almost every day. I use the platform every day multiple times for all of my meetings. And meetings actually is by now probably the killer feature, the thing that you use every day that makes the platform very, very sticky. And it also pulls in information from all the other modules, your past performance reviews, your past instant feedback, your current goals, and things like that.
And also you mentioned product market fit. How would you define product market fit? When did you know, like, oh, we're onto something, this is kind of working?
That's a good question. I think there's probably different phases of product market fit. I think we hit the first phase of product market fit with our initial pilots when customers were paying for instant feedback and learning. Of course, that first phase is not enough if you can't make it to the second phase and those customers actually stay customers over a longer period of time. And as such, I would say you need that time and you need both phases of customers paying for your product. I think that's crucial. You can't give it away for free. They need to actually realize that there is a value and they need to be willing to pay for it. And they need to do that over a certain period of time. It's not enough there if they only do it once, at least not in the subscription business.
How important do you think was your previous experience with Rocket Internet for you to build this company? And what do you think first-time entrepreneurs should think about when starting a company?
I think the model of Rocket Internet was very powerful in the sense that there's a lot of mechanics and methods that you learn from about starting a company in a very short amount of time. There was a lot of very ambitious, very smart people that can accelerate that learning.
Do you have some examples on the mechanics?
On the mechanics, very basically, like how to set up a Google Ads campaign that doesn't waste all your money very quickly, but actually generates some valuable leads, for example.
I just spoke with Kuhn from Insify and previously Blue Moon. Also, he was through Rocket Internet, and he called it the Formula One for entrepreneurship.
I guess it's a bit like consulting, where you also get a very condensed crash course on lots of different things. And yeah, very valuable experience.
And in 2022, you've raised 60 million euros Series A from Insight Partners, Creandum, and Visionaries Club. What was your funding strategy? Was it a plan to jump seed or it just happened?
So we never bootstrapped dogmatically. We always bootstrapped pragmatically and we bootstrapped for more than 5 years. So in a way, we skipped seed big time in those 5 years. We evaluated roughly every 3 months whether we wanted to raise funds now from the get-go. So we thought about it from the beginning and then had regular check-ins on if now would be the right time to raise funds for the company. And throughout those first 5 years, we always said, right now, our time is best spent on building product, on acquiring additional customers, on making the product stickier and things like that. And going out to raise funds would probably be a distraction and would not return on the investment of our time. What changed at the beginning of last year was a couple of things. We had a very clear goal of starting an office in the US, in New York City, and we knew that this would be expensive. There's lots of costs that come on top of things you would expect in Europe. We also knew that there were first signs in the market that things would deteriorate. And if we wanted to raise funds at all, ever, now would probably be a better time than in a year from now. We also knew that we had built a solid foundation of the business. We were roughly 50 people at the time. We had taken our time to grow to that size. And we thought that with that foundation, with that core of the company, we would be able to digest the funding and actually hire a bit more quickly without risking too much of the culture or risking culture at all, because we had that solid foundation. And all of these things taken together led to the decision to at least evaluate fundraising, as we set certain parameters that we wanted to achieve in terms of valuation and partnerships and the quality of partners and things like that. And then went out into the market and started talking to a few investors. And luckily, we're able to close that process rather quickly.
Were you profitable during these 5 years? When did you become profitable?
We were profitable at times, but more importantly, we were always cash flow positive. Profits were spread over the course of a year, and cash flow comes in at the beginning of the subscription year. So we were always able to fund the business from the cash flow.
And how much money did you put aside to take the risk of starting this business? So for someone listening, I want to start a business, I have this idea, maybe I have like one teammate. Like, did you plan for 1 year not earning anything, 2 years? How did you go about it?
I think we planned for roughly 1.5 years. And what you need, I mean, in Germany, you need 25,000 euros to set up a GmbH company.
Oh, really?
So that's the minimum you need. And you split that by two and you get 12,500. And actually, you can live for 1.5 years on a basic level without a lot of money. And so it was definitely not the most luxurious time of my life, but of our lives. But yeah, I mean, I would plan for probably 18 months. If you don't make any revenues after 18 months, it's probably also not a good sign. So that's where I would start.
So how does it feel from, you know, having a rough 1 year, 1.5 year to actually raising 60 million euros Series A from some of the greatest investors, both locally and internationally, and realize that you're actually a millionaire on paper?
That's probably not the question I would focus on. I think it's more interesting to ask how leading a company that's VC-backed is different from leading a company that's bootstrapped, because a few things do change. We now have quarterly board meetings, which are new for us. They're super helpful. And the investors are great sparring partners. So all the strategic, but also operational ideas we can discuss with the investors. Insight, for example, has a huge operational team as well, which we can approach at all times with operational questions on how do we set up, I don't know, a new compensation scheme for sales? How do we build brand more effectively in a new market? Things like that. So this new sparring partner is definitely new and super helpful. I think coming from bootstrapped to VC-backed, you need to place special emphasis on staying frugal and maintaining what made you strong in the first place, and being very frugal, being very efficient, not wasting any money. And of course, with the additional money that's suddenly available, there is a certain temptation to just spend more money on certain things. And then in some cases, that definitely makes sense to take certain risks, which you can now take. That's why you raise funds. But overall, you should obviously keep the muscle that made you strong in the first place. And with that also comes to not lower hiring standards in any way, which of course can also be a challenge if you want to hire more quickly and you suddenly have to fill additional roles more quickly than you used to in the past. Because I think what made us strong as a company, what built a very strong cultural core, is also the fact that we had to take a lot of time to hire the initial team because we just couldn't afford any mistakes in that area.
And 60 million euros Series A is a lot of money. What type of metrics does a startup need to raise $60 million? Is it a low CAC, word of mouth, big, a wide space in the market, strong net revenue, retention? What is it?
I mean, the question is obviously a thing I can only ask for the point in time of last year. And it's probably a very different answer today. I don't think it would be possible today and with the metrics we had last year. In our case, we had passed 10 million in ARR mark as a bootstrap company. We had a very low CAC payback for a company in our space. We had some very happy customers, including larger ones like Spotify, for example, which had been around for many years and were happy. Strong net retention, because companies that would add additional seats or would buy additional modules in the platform, and very strong growth. We had tripled the year before that. We had tripled the previous year. So there was a very clear and positive trajectory for the company as a whole.
Wonderful. Congratulations, by the way. And it seems that now you have the war chest for the next maybe 2-3 years just to weather the storm.
Hopefully even a bit longer. Yes. Thank you.
And you mentioned that you wanted to open an office in New York. I have some friends actually also here in Stockholm that are thinking to opening an office there. What would be your advice to them? How to strategically think about it? When should you open an office in New York? And what can you do actually from your base market?
That's a good question. And we actually tried to start the office 2 years earlier, at the beginning of 2020. Both Jenny and I were in New York for a couple of weeks at the time. And then obviously 2020 was a very bad time to start a new office in New York because of the pandemic that suddenly hit. And we had to cancel those plans. I think in hindsight, it's probably good that we didn't start it at that time. It would have been maybe a bit too early. I think what really helps in this case as well, just like with the funding, is to have a very strong cultural core foundation in place in wherever your home is or as a company as a whole before you venture into new markets. Because I think that starting an office is easy enough. The real question is, how do you make it durable and sustainable, especially from a cultural perspective? And connected to that is, how do you transfer culture and knowledge to the new location? How do you make sure it becomes one company across different locations instead of one office in Berlin and then a completely separate and different office in New York? And for us, that meant that we actually spent a lot of time preparing, sending part of the existing team to New York. So there's roughly seven people that went over to New York to form the core and to transfer culture and knowledge to all the new team members that we would hire in New York. And that takes time to prepare in terms of visa processes and the likes. And I think it has really paid off. So far, it's still a bit too early to tell. We started the office roughly half a year ago. But so far, signs are very positive that this is working well. And we're actually forming one global culture instead of different subcultures. But it does take time. It is amazingly expensive to hire people in New York. It's also something that's considered if you want to do this. I think anywhere in the US is expensive from a European perspective.
You mentioned culture a couple of times. How do you build a great culture?
I think that also depends a bit on the stage of the company. I think in the early days, it probably a bit more implicit than now, where you can essentially just role model it as a founder. If you're all still in the same room, it's easy to kind of just be the example and try to align via just being the example. What changes over time, I think, is that you need to make it much more explicit, communicate a lot more around it. And that's what we're doing now. And then there's different parts. So it starts with hiring, it goes through onboarding, through regular feedback and other processes. So for us on the hiring side, we have, for example, a culture fit interview that's dedicated to asking specific questions around culture fit, what we want to see in candidates, but also to see if it's a match from the other side, because they can be a great candidate, but maybe not the best fit for our culture. And it goes in both directions. Then for the onboarding, we have lots of different sessions, but one is dedicated to purpose and values. And it's super important to have that early on in the process and have that conversation between us founders and all the new employees to kind of align on what's really important and how we want to live those values. And then, as I said, it's part of lots of other processes as well. So there's the regular feedback talks, the one-on-ones, the engagement surveys that we run, things like that.
Got it. And what inspired you to build this specific culture? Were you inspired, or is just based, as you said, based on your own and Jenny's model? What do you guys think should be a great company to work with?
I mean, in the end, we started this company because we want to make work more meaningful for everyone. That's the impact that we want to see as founders, as a company. And we provide software that helps you to achieve that, to establish certain processes that bring you closer to having a meaningful experience at the workplace for your employees. But of course, we also have the ambition to role model that as a company and to be really a place that provides that environment, provides that very close alignment, that provides that very meaningful experience. And that's why we're pursuing that. So it's kind of what we want to see in the market, what we want to see as impact. And of course, we also want to lift that internally so that ideally in a couple of years, people, if they refer to great company culture, refer to LeapSum as an example, and not to the, I don't know, bigger ones that are more well known.
Netflix comes to mind when you talk about culture.
Netflix, for example, yes.
Yeah. I actually want to circle back just a little bit because I think you went through this very interesting journey, bootstrapping for 5 years and then getting the money from VC. You were at 10 million ARR when you got the money with a sticky product. I was wondering what were the challenges selling up to 1 million ARR? And what were the different challenges from 1 million to 10 million when trying to, maybe we can go more specifically in sales, for example?
Yeah, I would say we went through the very typical trajectory that most startups probably go through, where in the beginning you have lots of founder-led sales, where both Jenny and I were doing lots of demos, talking to customers directly, kind of winning the early important deals. There was a lot of fun, actually. but that doesn't scale. So you have to start building an actual sales team if you are working in a sales-led motion. And that's actually surprisingly difficult to kind of transfer the knowledge and all the things that you know as a founder to the early sales employees, and then enable all the following employees to be just as great salespeople as you think you are as a founder. And yeah, that's the transition that we went through and are still going through. I mean, it's an ongoing challenge to build a sales organization that is really scalable and delivers very predictive results while providing a very fun environment.
And at what point in the revenue did you hire the first salesperson, and what position was it? Was it like a sales rep, an account executive? Did you want someone maybe chief something to build the whole sales team?
No, we hired an account executive. I don't know the exact revenue stage, but I think it was less than 1 million still. And that person actually went on to become a core leader of the organization as well. So we hired not the sales leader first, but started with an actual salesperson that would sell directly and would not start by hiring his or her team.
How big was the sales organization at 10 million ARR?
That's a good question. So overall, we were roughly 50 people. If you include everything, everyone, so leadership team, account executives, and the sales development team, a bit more than 20 people probably. So a large team already.
What does the future of Leapsome look like? What are your aspirations or ambitions?
So I would probably put it in three buckets, one being business, one being the product, and one being people. In the first bucket of business, we have certain revenue ambitions. Of course, we are on a very good trajectory. We have certain metrics that we want to reach in the next couple of years. Of course, the North American market is an important part of the equation of reaching those. That's why we're placing so much emphasis on that market as well. On the product side of things, we have this platform for performance management, employee engagement, OKR management, learning, and compensation management by now. And we call it people enablement as a category. We think that the true value of the platform eventually comes from the fact that it's a platform that's very interconnected. So you can actually connect learning paths to feedback you've received, where you can segment your engagement results by performance quantiles and things like that. So it's not just standalone modules, but it's actually very interconnected and much more powerful because of that. We want to focus on that. We also want to focus on making the platform even more intelligent. So going from just serving analysis to serving actual recommendations based on the data that we generate. Because there's lots of interesting things that you can recommend to a company, to a team, to an individual in terms of how you can grow and evolve better. And on the people side of things, we, as we were discussing before, we want to really be a role model for a very modern and forward-looking and learning-oriented workplace where people really thrive and feel that work is meaningful. So that, as you said, maybe in a couple of years, people don't look up to Netflix, but they look up to Leapsome.
We'd love to see that European company there as the leader. And let's change gears a little bit and let's get personal. After closing 60 million A round, the company was valued at around 300 million, which made you guys millionaires. How did your view on life change once you became a millionaire?
So we actually never confirmed that number, and I can tell you it's not entirely accurate. But that's besides the point, I think. Again, I would say the really interesting question is not so much how it changed our lives, and if it did, I don't think it did. But how it changes the company and how it changes managing a company. That's what we discussed before. At the board meetings, you have the need to focus on remaining frugal, on staying efficient, even though you have lots of money available and you need to keep very high hiring standards, things like that.
Like, do you think money is a taboo to talk about money and to talk maybe being a millionaire?
Maybe that's a German thing. I don't know. In Germany, it is to some degree, and not well perceived to talk a lot about money. I think that's somewhat different in other countries.
So you haven't made a purchase that maybe you couldn't afford before? You'll be like, well, you know, actually, now maybe I can buy this, I don't know, house or Porsche or...
I honestly, it didn't really change anything much for me. And I'm a coffee nerd. I bought a new coffee machine. That's literally the only thing I would have bought before. But yeah, I think it's probably also a personal thing. For me, it's more about coming to work every morning and thinking, wow, this is an amazing team, such a cool vibe. Very cool to see all these friendships evolving. Great to see how individuals are progressing from being an individual contributor to the team lead to maybe at some stage department head and things like that. And that's what gives me energy and why we are doing this.
Great job. You seem very thoughtful, personable, and have the right mission to build a great company. And what is a book that had an impact on you as a CEO? Netflix, No Rules, Rules.
Yeah, I read that. That's a good book. I'm highly recommended if you're interested in the space. I'm not a huge fan of business books overall. I really like biographies. I have two biographies in mind right now. One is a biography about Benjamin Franklin by Walter Isaacson, I think, the same guy that also wrote the Steve Jobs biography. Very interesting character, very diverse talent. It's lots of interesting things at the time. I think today this would probably not be possible, but a very entrepreneurial nature and also very good at building routines, which comes across several times in the book. And I think as a founder, having strong routines in your daily life is one of the most powerful things you can work on. And as such, that was a very interesting role model. The other biography I have in mind is a book called Invention of Nature. It's a biography about Alexander von Humboldt, written by, I think, Andrea Wolf. Also a very interesting personality, obviously amazing scientist, ingenious traveler who traveled the entire world at a time where this was much more difficult than it is today. So yeah, those two I found personally quite entertaining and interesting role models as well.
I read the first one. It's a massive book. I've listened to it actually 45 hours. It's a week of listening.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
If you look back, what would you attribute the success of Leapsome to? It would be like one thing.
One thing, that's tough.
Okay, three things.
Oh, thank you. That's a bit more generous. I think there's lots of things that play a role in the end. Let me think about this. I think it really helps if you have a passion for what you want to build. And we are really passionate about building a great culture and helping other companies building a great culture, because that gives you the energy that you sometimes need to persevere if things are not going so well, which will inevitably happen or will happen in most cases. And I think that's where some companies fail if you don't have that. I think a great co-founder relationship is really important. I mean, failures of startups are very frequently attributed to failure of co-founder relationship. And I think in our case, it really helps that we have very complementary profile. I could focus on product marketing and customer success. Jenny could focus on salespeople and ops. We align on all these strategic topics very well. And I think that really helps. And then it's timing and luck, to be completely transparent. I think if we had started this company 10 years ago, I'm not sure if it would have been successful. In the current time, we hit a nerve. We did see an acceleration throughout the pandemic as well. And yeah, timing plays a massive role, I think, in any startup.
And also you mentioned the importance of routines as an entrepreneur. Do you want to tell us about some of your routines?
I was fearing for that question because I did have a very strong routine, but I don't have anymore. So now is not a good time to ask that question. But for a while, and I'm trying to get back to that, I would get up in the morning, go for a run, journal for a couple of minutes, write down what I had experienced in the past day, and just kind of stream of conscience that came to mind. I would even meditate. But right now it's very spotty and I only do some of these things almost some of the time. So yeah.
And the last question, if Kaitan from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell him?
I would probably tell myself long-term, it's going to be a lot of fun. And there are just certain things that will not go well, but you can't really avoid them. I think if you want to learn something, you sometimes have to go through the mistakes and have to actually experience what you're doing wrong to really internalize that. So I wouldn't really tell myself there's a trap right there, don't step into it. I would say there's a trap, you will step into it, but you will benefit from that in the end.
Enjoy the trap. I love that.
Enjoy the trap.
Love that. Kaitan, thank you very much for taking the time. This was very, very generous of you. It seems that you are also very, very thoughtful around culture. So I would love actually maybe to do an episode only on that when the time is right. But thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time. Very much appreciated.
Thank you. A lot of fun.